You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Actually, inappropriate music because he's not a Goo Goo Doll guy. He's kind of a different age of music than that. So joining me right now is Ken Rogers. Ken, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. I think my phone thinks you're a telemarketer. So
why would your phone? Now, let me ask you a question. Hold on. I'm going to press a button. I'm asking if you can hear me better or worse. And we will do that. And I have to keep talking here for a second because I have to set an audio level. And, well, you might have to live with this. Okay, I'm sorry. So, until I get that figured out. First of all, right. I'm not a telemarketer, okay? Stop doing that. Make your phone stop doing that to me. Alright, okay. So I don't know, I don't know what the deal is, but I'm tired of this kind of tyranny in my life, okay? So, let's put an end to that bullshit. Memorial Day is coming up. Thoughts of a Vietnam veteran 51 years removed from the hills of Khe Sanh?
Well, let's see. My thoughts on that are that I'm not going to be involved with any Memorial Day stuff this year because I'm going to go to Oregon and look for great gray owls. So,
great what? Elves?
Great gray owls.
You're a bird watcher now?
My wife is a bird watcher, and I do what I'm told, man. So,
so you follow Betty, and you're her Gunga Din?
from time to time, that's true, yes.
Well, that's interesting.
That's how we've survived. Long time together, man.
I noticed that when we were together. What about, so is there a secret to finding the great leprechaun owl of the Oregon? Whatever the hell it's
called?
Well,
we're going to go over and there's a woman who works for the Forest Service. She's a biologist that knows where they nest, and so she's going to take us out to see them, so.
Interesting. All right. So she can take you out on the bird watching event. Okay. Do you enjoy?
Yes, sir.
Do you enjoy it? Do you like bird watching?
Well, I like to get out in the woods. So I mean, it beats going to L.A. Okay. So,
whoa! Hey, I don't. Let's no need to get personal about all of this.
Why not?
I don't know where the hell that came from. Like, what the hell, man? Now, let me ask you this: is it your biorhythms that define whether you participate or not in Memorial Day? Because everybody has their own kind of way of doing that, depending on how they feel in given years. Have you gone through cycles where you didn't participate and didn't want to participate and then kind of gravitated back to it and then gravitated away from it? Give me the history of your Memorial Day. Let me predict. There was a long time that you didn't go anywhere near Memorial Day.
Memorial Day service up. Hello?
Yes. Hello. All right. You were hearing yourself, yes?
Yes, sir, I was.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
So anyway, we used to go to the Memorial Day service here up at the Idaho Veterans Cemetery, and but I was involved in Armed Forces Day, some of the Armed Forces Day stuff here last week, and that was enough for me. So
let me ask you this: does some of that stuff piss you off?
No.
Okay. All right. I had somebody tell me that last year they almost walked off the stage because of this. Was it you? They started saying, like, it was because it was a Vietnam era guy who stood up. I'm trying to think who said it, who told me. And they said it was the same stupid shit they said during Vietnam. And it made me so angry. I almost got up off the stage and walked away. That wasn't you.
No, that wasn't me.
Okay, it was somebody. It was like, yeah, it pissed me off all over again. Oh, I know who it was. I know who it was. It wasn't you. So at what point did you, after years and years of kind of not being involved, do you remember the first Memorial Day event that you ever went to as a kind of as a Vietnam veteran?
Yeah, that was, after we moved to Idaho, we went up to the Idaho Veterans Cemetery, which is on top of a hill where you can look down over the valley, and it's like it was attended by, you know, there were a couple of Medal of Honor winners that are now passed on that were there, and of course all the politicians showed up and tried to convince everybody that they had fought in Vietnam when they didn't, but that's a different story. and anyway, I liked it. And we used to go every year to that, but it got to the point where there are so many people there, I don't want to deal with that. So
let me ask you this. What is your take on people lying about being in Vietnam? That must have a special, because, you know, who's a senator? Blumenthal?
Yeah, right.
I mean, first of all, being in Vietnam wasn't that great of a deal. I don't know if everybody listening knows that. It wasn't a great deal, that great of a deal. And coming home was certainly a below average deal if you were a Vietnam veteran. And if you didn't deal with any of that shit, to now claim that you were of that class, I don't want to say that's wrong as wrong could be, but it's right there with it. It's right there with it. What are your thoughts when you see that kind of shit?
You know, I don't, it's just kind of makes me laugh. I have acquaintances and friends that get really angry about it. You know, guys that I know that served in Vietnam, they find out somebody's claiming they were there, they go berserk. I mean, it just really pisses them off. But it doesn't, you know, I just kind of makes me laugh. It's like, you know, people are sick, man. I mean, it's like, somebody quoted to me one time, and I don't know if this is true, but I suspect there's an inkling of veracity to it, that there were like 3 million people that served in Vietnam, and one of the Census Bureau questions sometime in the past, how many people served in the military in Vietnam, and there were 11 million people said they did. Now, it's like all of a sudden, what wasn't popular is becoming popular, and I suspect the reason that people say that now, well, there's probably a lot of reasons. One of them, they may feel a little guilty about the fact that they didn't. The other thing is that now that it's not anathema to be a Vietnam vet, well, we'll just claim it then, and it makes us look better. I guess. Hell, I don't know.
It is a bit ironic, though, don't you think, that you, only 3 million served, but 11 million identify themselves as serving in Vietnam? Amazing. Amazing. No, I mean, I think it's different, though, like all things for your group of veterans. I mean, the price you guys paid was steeper. So to have somebody like want to, now that, you know, after all these years, you know, we seem to have been accepted now by the country. Now that it's cool, right? What is the saying? I was country before country was cool. I was a Vietnam veteran before being a Vietnam veteran was cool. I could see how that would piss people off. You probably have, you have a good attitude about it. Can you believe it's 51 years ago, over now, over 51 years that, or this year, the 51st year of, since you, you were in, Quezon?
Well, you know, I guess. I mean, it's like, I can believe it because it happened, but, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, just doesn't go away, and you know that. I mean, the stuff just, it sits on you like a wart or something that it can't be burned off, and you know, you just live with it, and it's depending on what memory flashes into your head, it can be extremely immediate and you're right back there, or it's, you can be more reflective about it. It just depends on the day and the time and what stimulates or triggers the memories. But, you know, sometimes I think that all of a sudden it's a long time. And, you know, I always thought that, that the guys, you know, when I was a young guy, that the guys that I met who had fought in World War One or who were in the Marine Corps in the 20s or the 30s, that was a long time ago. And all of a sudden, I'm it. So
you're that guy?
I'm the guy, man. I'm, you know, we're the people. We're the, you know, in another 10 years, we're going to be the only veterans, or 15 years. We're going to be it. We're going to be the old guys. I mean, and so,
yeah. How's it feel to be that guy? Cause I'm not far, that far behind you from being that guy.
Well, it's just, you know, I mean, it's like, how does it feel? Just. No, I mean, you can't get away from it. It's, you are the guy. I mean, that's the facts. Cool. So.
All right. I got an email for you. Mac, I watched Bravo again probably 3 weeks ago. And I just want to say that every time I watch that thing, I seem to get something else out of it. Although, after you've talked about it, I do see the vividness of Mr. McCauley's interview, and that really blows me away. Ken just referenced the immediacy of different memories. That's what I took away the last time I watched this. I had your comments echoing in my head as I watched it again. I could hear you saying, he's not telling that story, he's living it. I just want to commend Ken for the great work that he and Betty did, and I would ask what's going on with it. I know that he posts on LinkedIn on a regular basis about what's going on with Bravo, but could he give us an update with it? And also, how about an update on the new project? Oh, what do you want to do? Just run the whole interview for God's sakes? All right, Rogers, give us an update. What's going on with Bravo?
Well, let's see. We screened it in Arizona, and we screened it in North.
Well, hold on. You did more than screen it in Arizona, right? Tell everybody the event that you went down there with. I was trying to get over there, but I couldn't. I had other engagements.
Well, let's see. It was it's Arizona Marine Corps League.
Right.
Convention there, so we screened it twice while we were there. And while I was there, we also met with a bunch of Vietnam vets that have a coffee meeting once a week, and we all talked about Vietnam. And then the movable wall was there, and we went out to that and participated in flag raising with some of the Marine. I'm not in the Marine Corps League, but we were affiliated with them, and so we went to the meeting and we screened the film. And then later in March, we also went over to La Grande, Oregon, because that's where one of the guys in the film lives, Ron Reese, and we screened it there for a very it was a really great screening. A lot of people were there, and a lot of his friends, and I think they probably found out a lot of things about him that they didn't know. And now we're just, you know, it's available on Amazon Prime, and we have DVDs that we ran out, and I didn't know if I wanted to make any more, but I was instructed by my wife that I would, so we got some DVDs, and we're selling those, and you know, that project lives on, man. It just, I thought, you know, we'd make the film, and that would be it, and I was done, and it just keeps going on, and you know, I hear from people all the time, all over the country, and actually out of the country, about the story and about the film. So it, you know, I guess it'll just march on at its own pace. As for the other film, I Married the War, which is about the wives of combat veterans, we have basically have a rough cut, of the film now. So it's about 2 hours, and we are in the process of trying to figure out how we want to edit it. And then when we're done with that, we'll put some music to it and mix the sound, and hopefully we'll do that at Skywalker Ranch again, which is, was where George Lucas did all of his work, but now that belongs to Disney, but I think we may go down there and do it again and have the guy that did Bravo, whose name was Mark Berger, mix the sound, and then we'll do color corrections, and hopefully at the end of the year we'll be done.
That sounds really complicated. Is film?
It is.
It is. Is film complicated?
Yeah, it's complicated, and it's collaborative, and so you got everybody's opinions. You got to at least respect. So you know, you got editors, and you got sound people, and you got music people, and you got all the people that have invested time and money in your project, so they want to have a say in what it looks like, and so it's collaborative. So
doesn't sound very easy either. Radio audio is easy, right?
It's not easy, but it's also gratifying, because if you get the right mix of input and artistic and you know, people on subject matter, and it's moving and it's compelling story, then it's very gratifying.
All right, can you, here's another email. Mac, I too have become a fan of Ken and Betty. I'm curious, I just heard the title. Could he give us a little bit more about what the next project is all about? You've done it, you said it before, and obviously you have fans now, so could you tell everybody what I Married the War, that's the title?
Yeah, that's a working title, and I you know, it may be the title when we're done, but it certainly expresses what the film is about, I think. We have interviewed a number of women we could have interviewed men, but we didn't. We just interviewed women. So it's like there's 10 women in this film that were married to combat veterans. There are some women veterans in it, but they weren't in combat, but they have married men who were, the World War I, Korea, Vietnam War, and then Desert Storm and the Sandbox stuff of the 2000s. And basically we went to their houses and interviewed them in their homes and asked them about what it was like to live with somebody that was physically injured, had PTSD, had TBI, had survivor's guilt, had moral injury, and what it was like to live with them, and then what it was like. And it's not about the veterans, you know, it's about the women and what it, you know, of course their husbands' experiences are the spur of what we're discussing in terms of the experience for them and their families, but it's about the women, and they talk about what they, you know, how they deal with it. And, you know, it's a love story, man, about women who have lived with women. Some of these women have lived with these guys for 60 years and or longer, and dealt with, you know, serious issues. So that's what the film's about.
Let me ask you, you just said it's a love story. Let me ask you, so in the making of all of the making of this second documentary, what surprised you the most when making it?
I guess, you know, I'm not sure I can answer that question. What surprised me the most? I wasn't really surprised anything. Some of the stories surprised me. Let me put it that way. I mean, you know, I don't want to reveal any of the details here because
right.
you can, but, you know, some of the stories that some of the women told about their husbands were surprising to me about what they had endured in the relationship and they were still there. So this is
long before anybody even thinks there's a term such as PTSD, or let alone there's a way to treat it or anything like that. So this is
some of the women we talked to, that's their case, but some of them are not. Some of them are very. Some of the younger wives who are married to guys who are in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, they know a lot about the subject matter, man. And they're experts on it in how to hustle up treatment for their husbands. It's amazing what some of these women have done for their husbands. I mean, and the difference being that in the World War II and Korea veterans, they just bucked it up, man. It's just war. This is just one of the costs of all of us sacrificing for the good of the country. And then you have the Vietnam veterans where it's not so clear cut that the sacrifice was worth it. And the resulting, you know, response from the people that you're supposed to be working with that might help you into the new generation of women who are really hep on this stuff, man. I mean, they know where the tools are and what can be done to help their husbands. So that genesis of dealing with that actually is a very interesting thread in the story.
You know, it's in doing this job, one of the interesting things, and you just kind of talked about it, what was so different for Vietnam veterans was that the previous wars, maybe Korea not so much as World War II and World War I, right? World War II, guys come back to the affection of the nation, to the parades and stuff like that. Korean War, guys come back to the respect of the nation. Maybe not a celebration, but the respect of the nation. They went over and they did what they had to do. Vietnam guys come back, and they don't come back to the respect of the nation, at least in a lot of places. Some places they did. And then I would think that it certainly would make you question, is the juice worth, was that worth it? Look what it's done to us, because the respect at least mitigated, right, the subsequent effects in your life. You know, I did something that I had to do and my nation respects me and appreciates that. When there is none of that. Right. I think it's pretty easy to see why people would say, you know, what the hell, man? Why did you send me over there? Because that sure as hell wasn't worth it. You know, a bunch of us got killed, you know, and now the rest of us are trying to put our lives back together. And we don't even have your respect. We don't even have the respect of the nation. So I think it's pretty interesting things that you tap on in terms of, you know, I would say, God, in the land of shitty life, subsequent to, you know, doing that stuff, bearable because of respect, and when there is no respect, I mean, you could see how it's unbearable.
Well, yeah, it is. It's tough. It's tough to take. You know, I mean, it was really tough to take. I think it must have been about 1972. I went to a VFW with some people that I knew. So we were all Vietnam vets, and one of the guys was a VFW regular, and he said, let's go over to the VFW club. And we went over there, and I wasn't there 5 minutes, and I got told we couldn't whip our way out of a wet paper bag. And I didn't stay in there very long because it really pissed me off. And I had that happen a number of times. This is from people who supposedly were, you know, I don't know who they were. They claimed they were World War II veterans. It was just a total lack of respect, and they didn't know shit about what I'd done or the men I served with had done and what we had, you know, experienced. And, so it was hard to take. You know, and it's interesting. Last Saturday, I met two Marines. Young Marines are veterans, and one of them had been 3 tours in Iraq, and the other one had 2 tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we were talking about this subject, basically. And one of them said, you know, he said in World War II, everybody in the United States participated in some way in the defeat of the enemies. He said, you couldn't get butter, you couldn't get gas, you couldn't buy tires. Everything was rationed. Even if you didn't go off and fight, you participated in the process. And he said, in these wars since then, he says, you know, the people of the United States have no participation in it. And I thought that was an interesting thought about if you don't pay the price, if you're not asked to pay, then it doesn't mean shit to you.
Wasn't it General Pace that said, or was it General Amos that said, the Marine Corps is at war and America's at the mall?
Yeah, it's true. So, and the disconnect, you know, I remember back in the 90s, reading a book by a book called The Making of the Corps by I can't think of his name. He writes a lot about military stuff, and it was an interesting book. And in it, he talked about the disconnect between the warriors in the Marine Corps and society in general and how it was growing. And that people are home and they're living their lives and they don't have a damn clue about what the cost is and what it takes to do this fighting, and the people in the military are getting to the point where they resent it. Do I have resent? I think I've had some resentment about my acceptance here as a participating combat warrior in the history of the United States. I would say I've had some resentment. So
interesting. I just did a search for that quote, and the article that comes up is "We're at War, America's at the Mall." That's how a lieutenant colonel here in Baghdad summed up his frustration last week, and that illustrates your point that, you know, that you know, whether it was a paper drive or the metal drive or the rubber drive or gas rationing, you know, the collective commitment to it. And then the number of casualties that came home, not, you know, both killed and wounded, every community saw the sacrifice and then participated in it. And,
right.
And now it's not that way. And you know what to me, let me ask you this. What do you tell people about Memorial Day? I tell them two things. One, at some point, you know, teach your kids and your grandkids, get them together and have a moment of silence while you say grace over a meal, and make sure they know what the weekend's about. It is not about veterans. It is about a singular group of people, and that is those that have given their lives for this country and their families that live with that sacrifice. And tell them that what they owe, because that was never their ambition, right? The Marines of the Ghost Patrol, the Marines that you fought with, Ken, that I fought with, it was none of their ambition to be in a national cemetery with a piece of marble sticking out of their forehead at a young age. I mean, they had life's ambitions, and what we all owe them is to serve our communities and to serve the nation in some way. And you don't have to join the military. You don't have to join the Peace Corps. But this country didn't get to be the way it is because nobody gave a shit about it. You've got to give a shit about your community, and you've got to serve your community. And that's what you owe. That's what you owe them who gave everything. So that's kind of my message. Do you have any message about Memorial Day, what it means?
Well, I think that's a good message, and I normally don't say much about it because nobody asked me. But I think your message is a good one, and I ponder this notion about all these people that I know in this country who, you know, it's basically all about me. And it's about mine and what I can get, and not everybody, but enough people here that it concerns me that we as a country have lost the ability to recognize that we're in this together. And it ain't going to work if we don't all pull in the same direction. And I'm not talking about fighting combat. I'm just talking about making the system work. And there's so many people I can think of in this country who it's just basically is about what I can get. So, you know, I think your message is a really good message, because if we don't all participate in going forward down the road toward whatever's coming at us, it's not going to work very well.
Yeah, but and I don't mean to be Dolly Downer on a Tuesday morning, but do you have any reason to hope that our culture seems to be going in the exact opposite way?
Yes, it does, and it concerns me. But I think back to when I was a college student, and a course on political science, and the professor saying the first rule of political science is the world is ungovernable, and the only reason people ever get together and do something for the good of a larger entity like a country is when there is a genuine outside threat. And, you know, so I think the only thing that will pull us together as a country is something makes us forget about all our petty bullshit and pull together for the general good. So that means a war or something like that. Unfortunately, which is something I don't want to see, and I don't want to have to pick up a rifle and shoot somebody, but that's what I think.
You know, now let me take the elevator even lower now that I've done it. We all watched September 11th, and that didn't seem to do it, right? I mean, or it did it for a very short period of time. Normally what you're talking about, something that would transform the country, I mean, that's a pretty catastrophic, you know, so we're talking about an event in order of magnitude greater than September 11th, God forbid?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not sure that, you know, if I look at what happened in September, after September 11th, I'm not sure that it got handled right. Personally, you know, it's like I wasn't there, so my observations are basically based on what I saw from afar. But, you know, I think the public came to the conclusion that there was no genuine threat there from the enemy. Personally, that's what I think happened, you know. I mean, it would be a hell of a lot different if Soviet planes were flying over and dropping bombs on somebody. We'd get on the same page real quick. That's what I think.
Somebody just wrote me, that's what President Bush told America to do. Go shopping! !
Right. I remember him doing that, man. And I laughed, man. And my friends were all really angry at him for saying that. You know, it's how, you know, and I understand why he did it. You know, it's like we can't let these people stop us from being who we are. But if shopping is who we are, it's like, wow.
Yeah. No, you know, it's interesting. Hold on. Here's another email that actually pings on this. Mac, you're doing the Memorial Day Watusi here, trying to reconcile two worlds that don't seem to really go together. And that is the world that people live when they have to go kill people, have to go save people, and the urgency and the way that changes you with the reality of life that most Americans live, which doesn't have anything in common with that. We hope that they at least respect it. It seems for Vietnam veterans, what they deal with is straight up disrespect for decades. I think what younger veterans deal with is the ambivalence of the nation. Ambivalence, you don't hear that word on this program very often. The ambivalence of a nation. And they question whether people actually do care, which is really the basis for that movie, Thank You for Your Service. It's simply a phrase. They don't understand. And while it's better than what the Vietnam veterans got, I think most would tell you it's not that much better. All it is a little bit of frosting on that sentiment because they don't really care. You know what? That is the – I think we are doing that Watusi Rogers. And, the way I get to it is, hey, look, I think teach your kids that this country, that those names on that wall, they were real people, man. They played baseball and they drank beer and they looked at, dirty magazines and they wrote stories and they were Rhodes Scholars and they were all kinds of different things. Teach your kids that. Do not forget that throughout our history, people who really didn't want to get dead got dead, and we should respect that. And
that's right.
Here's another question about bird watching. Mac, is Ken actually a bird watcher, or is he, or it sounds like he's more support personnel for the bird watcher. How does that thing actually shake out? Yeah, are you into bird watching, or are you the ammo humper?
Well, I'm into the watching, man. I like to watch them and I like to identify them and I like to go for, I like to go out. In the country, that's the biggest thing for me. I like to go out and be out in the wild parts of the world where there's not an interstate and people with the mall and all that shit. So, yeah, I'm into bird watching, but I'm also the ammo humper. So,
how far now, your average bird expedition, is it more than 100 meters off the road?
Yeah, could be. Depends on what your life time to go see.
Wow. Here's another one. Here's another one for Bob Nielsen, another Vietnam veteran. I'd rather be bird watching too. I've never really got into bird watching. It's like, okay. I mean, some people would say, well, until you shoot them or something like that, where's the fun? I don't subscribe to that, but.
The only birds I was interested in for 45 years were the ones you could shoot with a shotgun and eat. When we moved to Idaho, we didn't know anybody, and I saw an article in the local newspaper about an outing with the Audubon group, and I told Betty that they would know where to go, and they would know where good spots were to go just to be out of the city, and probably would be some fairly intelligent people. So we went and met some great friends, and who are still great friends, and they were excited about birds. So we follow them around and got our binoculars out in our book, and here you go. What is it? It's a lazuli bunting, or a sandhill crane, or some kind of raptor that flies down and kills shit and eats it.
Good God, you're scaring the shit out of me. What about so you're a legitimate bird watcher now? Wow. Now, is there certain like clothes you wear? Do you look like Miss Jane Hathaway? Do you remember her? She would go bird watching. On the Beverly Hillbillies, she had like a pith helmet, Bermuda shorts, and kind of a safari jacket on. Is there any costume like that you wear, or is it
no?
No.
Well, no, but you know, you're now you're trying to put me in the same thing where you go fishing and you see the guy come by with a $7,000 in gear, you know? No.
That's not you.
No, that's not me and that's not us. You know, we have a car that we can go in the country in and we've got binoculars and a book and, you know, you take your, you pack your lunch and, or you take, you know, you take your coffee and you go out and you spend some time away from town.
Wow.
Or away from the city.
All right. Okay? No, okay. All right. I'm with you. I'm with you. It's just bird watching is bird hunting.
I can imagine you, you know, more than being a bird watcher. I imagine you being a woman watcher. That's what I think.
You know, I get bored. Like, I don't like fishing. Are you shitting me? Like, okay, let's get in the boat. We're going to get our asses chewed by mosquitoes. And now I'm talking about fly fishing, which is activity as you cast and reel and cast and try to, you know, catch a, you know, what do they catch? Trout? You know, big mouth bass? I don't even know. Up in the Sierras. I know they do it up there. But, they do it in Idaho too, I think. And so I think it's salmon. But anyway, like that to me, like, okay, I could do that. But I'm gonna sit in this goddamn boat and I'm gonna drop a line and wait for a fish to nibble on it? That's what I'm gonna do today? Come on.
Well, I don't do that.
Yeah, it sounds boring. Sounds boring as well. Shit. Now, even hunting, I would like I don't wanna shoot, I don't wanna kill anything. Like, so what I would do is like I would shoot the ground behind it and so the deer would know that I could have killed it because I'm a benevolent human being. I didn't know, and he would thank God. I don't know that deer think like this, but he should. Or I think I would most rather bow hunt and shoot a deer with a rubber tipped arrow that couldn't penetrate, just to let them know that, yo, bro, I had your shit. So that to me, but bird watching, that's a different. Okay, hold on. Here's a question. Mac, does Ken hold hands when he bird watches? Rogers, do you hold hands? Tell the truth, too. Because I'll know if you're lying. Do you hold hands when you bird watch?
No.
Okay. All right. Next question. Mac, does Ken have another documentary in him? Whoa. He didn't think he had a second one in him. Now we're asking about a third. What do you think, Rogers? After you come down off your post documentary high that you're going to have, are you going to have a third one in you?
Well, it's interesting. I've had a case on vet contact me about making a film about something that has nothing related to combat, although it would be exciting about a group of individuals who work in an extremely dangerous business, and he has a lot of contacts and experience in that. And it's tweaked my interest, but I'm not going to take that anything on until we get done. So
that sounds like a definite maybe.
Yeah, it could be a maybe.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm shocked, to be honest with you, because when I heard about the second film, I recall you saying, I never thought I would be doing another one of these because it's a lot of work. And so now
it is. But it's like it keeps you, you know, this is how you keep from wearing out, man. So, you got to keep your brain moving. You got to keep moving. You got to keep thinking. You got to keep having something to pique your interest to stay alive.
All right. Here's another email. He never holds hands! !! I'm not going to tell you who sent that. Next email. Mac, would you please ask Ken if he would encourage people to take film classes that are looking to find a voice? I'm intrigued by both images and film, and I would love to be able to give my experience in Iraq and Afghanistan some kind of voice. Or should I simply just do it? So classes or do it? What say ye, Rogers?
Well, you know, it depends, I think, on what kind of person you are. It would certainly, if you took classes on you know, I mean, you have basically people with, you know, you got the story and you have to be able to generate the story through a script in some method that makes it compelling. But then there's the technical aspects of somebody's got to shoot it, somebody's got to record it,
right,
and somebody has to edit it. If you take classes and you know how to do that, you will understand the process really well, and you also be able to do a lot of the work and save yourself a bunch of money. The other side of it is, we just did it, and I don't care about being able to do all of the stuff, because I think when you bring people into your project from different disciplines and allow them to participate, the potential for something a little beyond History Channel droning music, boring documentary stuff is possible. So, you know, I took some classes on production because understanding the money end of it, I think, is pretty critical, because money is an issue. You can do it either way. We just jumped in. You know, if we'd have known what we were getting into, we probably wouldn't have done it. So, you know, it's heady. It's a heady business. It's heady and it's fun and it's depressing and it's, you know, it's just living life in the fast lane kind of. You want to tell your story? That's a good way to tell your story. Yeah, but that's not the only way to tell a story. You can write it. You can write your experiences. You know? There's some now, some, I think, some pretty good stuff coming out about the sandbox. So, and some of it's very unique. I think of, there's a guy named, what's this guy's name? Brian Turner, who was, in the army in Iraq and prior, he was in Bosnia, I think, or Kosovo. And he writes poetry, and he's written a memoir called My Life as a Foreign Country, which is pretty, will get your attention, about his experience fighting and dealing with the shit at home. So writing is one way to do it, or you can be like Mac and
just run your yap.
Yeah, pardon?
I said, and just run your yap.
Right.
Yeah, so you can do that. Yeah, I you know, again, I think I think there is some merit, and again, I think it, like Ken said, it depends on your personality. But I think there is an element of, if you think it too much, you won't do it. You won't do it. And I think part of me says, just get out there and do it, and then play it forward. You'll know if you have anything that's worth value, and other people, you know, other people either commenting on it or helping you, I think only make it better and provide you the encouragement that you need. So I could go be somebody's assistant and go to classes. Okay, that's fine. I want to do it and I want to learn the lessons. And then after I know a bunch, then I think I can get more out of, the classes that I would take, if that makes sense.
Well, I think that's very a valid approach. And I think that, you know, that's one really good way to look at it. The deal about making films, or anything that you want to do when you want to tell a story, is
okay. Hold on. Let me interrupt you. What was your idea? Because the story is, you guys had gone to a reunion, right? And Betty had been to enough of this stuff, and it was her idea originally. It said, "Hey, we should record some of this stuff." Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So when you guys were going to record it, what was your original idea? What were you going to do with it? Just give it to your friends?
You know, we didn't know. I mean, we didn't even know. I mean, the more of it was the stories needed to be recorded because they were going to get lost.
Right.
Okay. And my wife decided the best way to do that was a film, and I agreed because I didn't know shit. Okay. So that's the way it goes. But once we got involved in it, it was great fun. Here's the deal about any of this stuff, I think. This is my opinion about all this. Mm-hmm. If you want your story to get out there, you think you have something to say, and you want to tell a story, and you want to be able to share it with people so you can help people understand what this shit's all about, you need to be able to just overcome whatever damn obstacle gets in front of you. Okay? It isn't like it's like taking a hill or taking a, you know, going house to house fighting. You got to overcome the asshole in there trying to kill you. Okay? Similar thing when you make films or you want to, you know, when you want to publish a story, you just have to keep at it, man. You have to be able to take getting kicked in the gut and keep going. That's my advice.
There you have it, straight from the horse's mouth right there. The one and only Ken Rogers. All right, what's left on your to-do list for the day? Where are you headed? What are you doing?
I'm going to go pump iron, man.
Are you? You're going to go get rocked? Get ready to go burn? Do you do that in an effort to stay physically fit so you can go be Gunga Din and get out there and watch those owls?
Yeah, I need to chase those owls around. Plus, I got issues with my knees, so I need to go to strengthen all the muscles around them because I ain't replacing them. No.
You're not?
No, shit, no.
A lot of guys say that once they do that, like if I would have known that I would have felt this much better, I'd have done it years ago.
Yes, sir. That's true. I mean, I go over and I lift weights, and I feel a lot better.
What, your brain or your body or both?
The whole thing. Yeah. Everything works better.
I'm with you. Right. No, part of mental fitness is physical fitness, man. It's just what it does. All right. Well,
you got to do it.
No, I agree with you. I agree. You know what? I mean, you honestly, you're kind of a poster child for post-traumatic winning. You don't know that. I don't like to tell you that. But, no, I mean, I quote you. There's certain people I quote in it all the time because you know, I mean, you talk, I play an audio clip of you, when I do post-traumatic winning, talking about alcohol and what it'll do to your life. And I could almost recite it, but towards the end you say, and you got to understand, I was drinking about a case of beer a day, and a bottle of wine or a half a fifth of whiskey. So I was drinking substantial amounts. And when people hear that, They like, oh my God. And then I make the point that, you know, look, he did that for 25 years. Is that the number I remember?
I said, that's close.
He did that for 25 years. I said, that's the kind of pain that we're talking about, you know, that we're either numbing ourselves from, we're running from, or you're trying to coexist with. And, right, as he says, you say, it will destroy your life.
That's right.
It will destroy your life. And, in fact, I should play that audio cut if I can find it. Hold on. Give me one second. If I can find it, I'll play the son of a bitch. But I love it because, well, it starts with, you're an asshole. If you drink with PTSD, and let me just tell you this. Everybody laughs when that plays, okay? Everybody laughs when that plays. If you drink when you have PTSD, and you say something else, and then you stop and you say, you're an asshole. You're an asshole. And then everybody laughs. And then you go on and you tell your story. And I use you as somebody in the whole thing, hold on. Alcohol and PTSD. Ken Rogers. Here you go. Here's what gets played in post-traumatic winning.
If you do it long enough to get to a point where you accurately describe what you do, you destroy your life. You destroy the lives of the people who love you. You destroy your friendships because people just get tired of putting up with you. I mean, you know, you're an asshole. When you drink and have PTSD, you're an asshole. I was. I was just an ass. I was sarcastic, cynical, pissed people off, hurt their feelings, and didn't care. It was like, and until I, you know, I got married a second time, I was still drinking heavily, and, but I married a woman who understood that I needed to be able to articulate what had happened to me in Vietnam, and she listened, and I came to the conclusion that she wasn't going to stick around very long if I didn't get my shit together.
There it is. Now, you know what sticks out at me every time I hear that? And I clipped the end of that, just so you know, that where you talk about the half a case of whiskey and or the case, right, the case of beer and well, wait a minute. Let me play the long version of it.
They're your worst enemy.
That's
and
my,
I,
that's my
I got married a second time. I was still drinking heavily. And but I married a woman who understood that I needed to be able to articulate what had happened to me in Vietnam. And she listened. And I came to the conclusion that she wasn't going to stick around very long if I didn't get my shit together.
That's a short version too. Anyway, but it what catches my ear every time you say it is you talk about being an asshole, right? And you said, you know, and I'd hurt people's feelings, and here's the part that catches my eye, and I didn't care. And every time I hear you say that, I think that's what one of the things that people don't realize how deep this stuff is. And why we've got to do the things that we talk about doing, which is talking about it, which is, you know, getting each other away from alcohol and self-medicating, because it only releases the worst demons into the lives of the people we care about. But you're talking about being so angry, so hurt, and so bitter that you're doing it and you don't even give a shit that you're doing it. You don't care that you hurt other people's feelings, which is a far cry from a bird-watching filmmaker that you become today.
Not so much.
What? It's not?
Nah.
Okay. All right. I will take your word for it. But no, but you're a poster child, in my opinion, Kim, for post-traumatic wearing. And to me, it's really amazing. There's a common thread between you, William Manchester, and I know you're going to recoil at this, Eugene Sledge, who wrote With the Old Breed, Manchester, who wrote Goodbye Darkness, and other people that have written about their experience, you know, telling your story, right? I know people say finding your voice, but I hate that. But, you know, just articulating it, there's a lot that goes into that in terms of introspection and articulating and thought. It's such a healthy thing. And I think it takes a lot of people to a different and better place, and it helps other people too. So I found that very interesting. The number of people that once they told their story, how it fundamentally changed their life. So I think that's, I think that's an interesting
point. I agree with that.
Did you ever think telling your story would have that kind of impact on you?
No.
Betty did.
I just was compelled to tell it. So, I mean, it was like it needed to get out. All right. It needed to get out. I could tell that somewhere down in my guts where, you know, those places where you don't think about stuff, you just know it on some kind of other level. So I just knew that I needed to tell a story. And I think that that's the, you know, I think that every combat veteran should tell the story. Because when you tell the story, it does a lot of things, I think, but one of the things it does is it makes you look at what happened to you, and you're doing it from a different place, a little more introspective, a little more removed, and I think that helps you put it in some place where you can deal with it better.
You know what? I think it helps you coexist with it, right? Telling your story,
right.
And you can't ever, as Ken said when we started this thing, you know, sometimes memories are good, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're really vivid, sometimes they're less, but they're always there. And so I think that truth, you know, understanding that truth and then, you know, what you just said is I don't know that you can give Then let me, this will be the last question I ask you today. I've kept you too long. When I think about the paradigm for treatment of veterans, it is we're gonna medicate you, and then we're gonna send you to some kind of talk therapy. All right. What I've concluded, and my thoughts aren't final; they're constantly changing. But you know, while medication I think might be necessary for short periods of time, and for some, I think a small group of veterans, for longer periods of time. It should be low doses, short amounts, and there should be a plan. When you go on, there should be a plan to get you off. Two, but medicating can't get you to good. It can't get you to a good place. It can get you to a diminished version of what you used to be. Talking about it, can that get you to good? I don't think it can. It can help you accept some stuff. It can help you maybe not blame yourself for certain things, but that too is a diminished version of what you used to be. The only way, and this is what I want your thoughts on, the only way to get it to good is you have to give of yourself to get it to good. You have to give of your feelings, you have to give of your thoughts, and you have to give to others. And I say in the whole preaching of the gospel of post-traumatic winning, that if you give up the truth of your experience, that you're not getting it, get over it. The truth about alcohol abuse that you told me, Ken, and the truth about talking about it with your spouse. If we share those truths along with our experience, we can transform the lives of other people. You and Betty have done that with your film, and you'll do it again with the next one. And that is the only way to get it to good. And to give, as Frankl says, to give your suffering meaning. So I'd be curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, I self-medicated. I'm medicated. So I know that. I just don't think that that all that does is allow you to hide from the reality of the pain. It's okay. I understand why they do it and some guys need it, but, to me, that is just you're treating the symptoms. You're not getting at the root of the problem. But talking about it's good for the biggest reason for, I think, to talking about it with other veterans is good is because you know you're not alone.
Right.
And for me, that being alone for all that time or feeling I was alone was that was an issue. So, but when you are forced to tell your story and try to explain it to people who don't have a goddamn idea what you have gone through, I think that's where the meat of the subject comes with, because you are going to come face to face with the person that you are now versus the person that you were then before it ever happened and all the shit that happened to you in between and an acceptance that, hey, this happened to me. This happened to me. I can't get away from it. I can't avoid it. It's not good for me to get away from it. It's not good for me to avoid it. It's the best thing for me is to think about and articulate it, because when you articulate it, you're forced to think about it. And that's what I think.
There you have it, the Sage of Idaho, Ken Rogers. Actually, the sage of Idaho is Betty Rogers. Ken is the front man today. So anyway, hey, hold her hand, for God's sake. What's wrong with you?
I got PTSD, man.
I got PTSD. Yeah, but she's not afraid of any of that shit, man. She likes it. She's one of those girls. Yeah. When I met Betty, I told her that. I said, these guys are interesting, but the girls who like them are a lot more interesting because they got way more issues. She started laughing. She said, I said, I know. I pay attention. I'm nobody's dope. So anyway, first of all, man, thank you for coming on and doing this. I always love having you on. And as I said, Ken, you are, one of the posters of post-traumatic winning. And I just want you to know, to this day, and I knock on wood every time I say it, but, your story has been part of the story that post-traumatic winning is writing. And that is in the 2nd Marine Division, close to 18,000 Marines, there has not been a suicide since I gave that thing in January.
And that's great.
And your story, your brutal honesty, and in particular for young people about alcohol, right, and some of the other things that I quote you as saying lands with a thud, and it needs no salesman, which is another quote that I made up. I made up this quote at the start of the presentation, and I put Kanye West's name on it so they'll think it's cool. And so I say, and as Kanye West says here, the truth lands with a thud, and it needs no salesman. And then I tell him, and I say, and if Kanye West says it, what do we know about it? And half the audience says it's bullshit, and then the other half says it's legit. And I said, yeah, but he didn't say that. I said it, and I put his name on it so you guys would think it was cool. And which they all think it's funny. But it is the truth. And that came to me interviewing a squad leader from India 39, fighting not too far from Quezon, southwest of Kantian, in a battle that's called Getlin's Corner, about a year prior to you being at Quezon. And when he was talking about the NVA tried to overrun the company CP after they sent out three platoon size ambushes, the NVA waited and then they tried to overrun them. And Lieutenant Bobo's Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, 6 Silver Stars, and 3 Bronze Stars in a 5-hour fight. And as he was talking about it, and then what they've lived through subsequent to that, which is the exposure to Agent Orange and all the other shit that you guys have lived with, that quote came into my head. Holy shit, man. That stuff lands with a thud, and it doesn't need any salesman. And what's cool is that Marines will email me, and they'll put that quote in there saying, it's like, the brutal truth that you gave us does land with a thud, and it doesn't need a salesman. And I know that when guys hear me say, you know, the seventh commandment of post-traumatic winning is if you drink and you deal with substantial trauma, you're going to wind up living alone or living with your dog. And the only reason your dog is there is because your dog doesn't have a vote. And I always say after that, what I say it like, okay, and I know there's a whole bunch of you sitting out there thinking, fuck you, old dude, I ain't giving up my booze. And that's fine. But at some point, you're gonna understand the truth to this, and you're gonna need to change the way you live your life. And so take it and just put it in your brain, and someday it'll mean something to you. But a whole bunch of that wisdom comes from you, and you and Betty and your exploration of your experience. So I can't thank you enough, tell you how much I respect what you guys have done, how much I respect you as a guy after all that you've been through, and then how much you share, and in particular how good you've been to me. So thank you very much.
Well, you know what? Carry on, because you're doing great work, and Semper Fi.
Semper Fi, their devil dog. All right. Good luck with that bird watching shit, man.
Yeah, I'm looking out the window right now at a bunch of really red-headed house finches.
All right, Ken, have a great day. Unbelievable. You know, one of the coolest things, I told somebody yesterday, man, I have one of the coolest jobs on the planet. And, you know, in fact, I do. And it's the people that I've met. It's the people that I've met along the way that, you know, from Bob Nielsen, who's changed my life, to Ken Rogers, who's been a lot of things to me. He's been a part mentor, because he's gone down this road of telling stories that I've gone down. He's been part, like, exhibit for me to watch and listen to and then observe. And then the things he shared, you know, to include that quote about alcohol. And I'm not getting off the air without playing the whole quote that I play of him. That was, I don't know. All right, stand by. Let me find the actual. Full quote that I used. Because at the end of it, I mean, honestly, Marines, like, they look and they're like, holy shit, man. That's like serious drinking. Like, hello? You think? And again, the other part of it is, right, for how many years? Yeah, for how many years? So give me 1 second to open this, and I will get the Ken slide, and I'll play the video from it. But no, hold on. All right. Here's the video. And it's Ken. It's actually my sister Peggy. Well, you know what? I'll play you all four of them talking about alcohol. And Ken's the final one. And I introduce the slide. I talk about my sister Peggy. I talk about Jeremiah Workman. I talk about Ross Pape. And then Ken is at the end. So I think the whole thing's about 4 minutes. So let me kill Steve Winwood. I mean, let me kill his song. Not let me kill him. But you'll hear Peggy, Jeremiah Workman. You'll hear Ross Pape, and then you'll hear Ken.
They're your worst enemy. And I like to party. What it does, drugs and alcohol, is they make you, they make your mind weak. And they make you vulnerable. They make you lose your reasoning. And they'll destroy you. You want someone to let the monkeys out of the cage, get a, you know, go ahead and drink a half a bottle of tequila and start thinking about your problems. The monkeys will destroy you. It doesn't help anything. Anything. It might make you feel better for 5 or 10 minutes, but it's your worst nightmare.
It all happened kind of at the same time. It was all part of the looking in the mirror and saying, holy shit, I am destroying myself, but not just me. My family is suffering. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of Marines and soldiers that I know that that I talk with, it's not until they realize that their family is suffering and most likely on the verge of leaving you,
right,
that they're willing to make a change.
Literally, the only thing that really made a difference for me, you know, I was on medications, anxiety, depression, blah, 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 you know, right, doing this, doing that, but yet quitting drinking was the only thing that really helped. And after I quit drinking, all the other things that the doctors were telling me all this time started to fall in place and started to freaking work, which, as you know, I'm stubborn. It's like, oh, they don't know what they're talking about, blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, when you're not lying to the doctor about how much you drink in a day or a week, and you could tell them that, yeah, I used to drink 3-4 cases of beer a week, you know, I mean, no big deal. Now I don't drink anything. And now you start actually listening, and you start doing the things they tell you to do, and you actually want to try and, you want to try and make your life better. It's amazing. But yeah, for me, quitting drinking was by far number one, the biggest step to handling my PTSD.
All right, here's all of Ken's.
You get to a, if you do it long enough, you get to a point where you accurately describe what you do. You destroy your life. You destroy the lives of the people who love you. You destroy your friendships because people just get tired of putting up with you. I mean, you know, you're an asshole. When you drink and have PTSD, you're an asshole. I was just an ass. I was sarcastic, cynical, pissed people off, hurt their feelings, and didn't care. It was like, and until I, you know, I got married a second time, I was still drinking heavily, and, but I married a woman who understood that I needed to be able to articulate what had happened to me in Vietnam, and she listened, and I came to the conclusion that she wasn't going to stick around very long if I didn't get my shit together.
So what makes you stop drinking, ultimately?
Well, you know, I just figured out that I was either going up or down, and it was my choice, and I better do it now because I was about past the point of no return. because I was like drinking a case of beer a day and then maybe a bottle of wine or half a fifth of whiskey or, you know, I mean, I was consuming large amounts of alcohol.
That's the whole quote. So, no, I mean, I have an awesome job, and again, but it's the people I've met along the way that have both inspired me and taught me about living with trauma. And the coolest part, though, has been bringing that to a population outside the veteran population that doesn't know a whole lot about trauma and seeing the impact and then knowing that we as veterans can have a huge impact on our communities in ways that we probably don't even understand. And so I think that's I think that's pretty exciting. So, but again, my point is this, guys like Ken Rogers, guys like Bob Nielsen, women like Katie Beasley, I mean, all have provided me great inspiration and have taught me stuff. And so I think it's pretty cool. And I would echo telling your story, whether it be you just write it, you know, for yourself. I think that's where it starts. Because, and that's what this song's about, Back in the High Life. Living a better life and helping other people live better lives. That's what makes sense to us. So that's what we should do. So I love having Ken Rogers on the program. Nah, he's a normal dude, man. Have a great day. If you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. You'll get to listen to me flail with electronic stuff in the first hour. I share a little bit of a letter that I read them, and they cause me distress because of what's in the letter from and the letter's from somebody serving in the Navy. And then you'll listen to the Commandant. Yeah, the Commandant made a little 50-second video about help. Yeah. So on a Tuesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio. Over and out.